A mystery is unfolding in Catasauqua. A young mother and her baby boy appear to have vanished.
There's an empty crib in the Katranach house on Front Street. He says the two have been missing since yesterday afternoon.
We're at a loss. The police are at a loss. You know, we don't know. Just, what do you do? You know, where do you look?
By December 16, 1994, word had spread fast about the missing young mother, Joanne Katranach, and her four-month-old son, Alex. Andy Katranach Jr., Joe's husband, had been up all night since he returned home from work on the 15th, searching for her, contacting authorities, canvassing the neighborhood. Flyers had been distributed and posted across Catasauqua, Pennsylvania, and neighboring towns. The media had picked up the story, and the police were finally taking Joe and Alex's disappearance seriously. Now, the most important thing that investigators needed to do was establish whether anyone at all had seen anything. Tracking down witnesses and evidence in the first day or so of an investigation is crucial, as this audience certainly knows. The sooner they could try and establish a timeline for Joe's movements, the likelier they were to find mother and child safe and sound. Investigators had a lot to piece together. And at first glance, there were a few data points that seemed well established about what Joe and others did that day. But on closer examination, the picture got muddier, and much of what they thought they knew may have just been red herrings. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Patricia Rohrer. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. As investigators looked into Joe's life, the picture that initially emerged was of a social, fairly well-liked young woman who made friends easily and stayed in touch with them frequently. Just 2 days before she disappeared, Joe had traveled to New Jersey with baby Alex to meet a group of friends she had worked with in New Jersey. Before marrying Andy, Joe had been working as a receptionist at the corporate Six Flags headquarters in Parsippany, New Jersey. That was when she first met and befriended Timothy Hale, worked in the mailroom at the time. In the days after Joe's disappearance, authorities interviewed Hale, who was a patrol officer by this time, about what he knew about Joanne. He told the officers that Joe had worked at Six Flags for about 7 months, eventually quitting in January of 1993 because she was going to be moving in with her boyfriend, Andy Katranach. Joe was friendly with her co-workers, he said, but not very close to anyone in particular. Still, Joe stayed in touch with her former colleagues, even after moving to Pennsylvania with Andy. In June of 1993, Joe had called him to tell him the news that she and Andy were planning getting married, and a couple of months later, he had called her to let her know he'd been accepted into the Morris County Police Academy. Joe seemed very happy in her marriage, and told Hale that she and Andy were planning on moving to Colorado eventually. Earlier that year, in the spring of 1993, the couple had taken a vacation out there and loved it. They checked out different towns and even explored job opportunities for Andy. The next time they connected was in December of 1993, when Timothy Hale called Joe to share the news that he had graduated from the police academy. Joe, in turn, shared some happy news as well. Her and Andy were expecting a baby. It meant putting off the plans for Colorado for a while and waiting until after the baby was born to make the big move. Nearly a year later, in October 1994, they connected again, when Hale called Joe to check in and see if all had gone well with the pregnancy. Joe told him she was now a mother to a little boy, and they made tentative plans to get together so that he could see the baby. That get-together finally happened on Tuesday, December 13, 1994, just 2 days before Joe disappeared.
They agreed to meet for lunch at TGI Friday in Parsippany, New Jersey at 1 p.m., and Hale also invited three other former colleagues to join them. Joe arrived at the restaurant with the baby around 1:15 p.m., and Hale recalled that she was wearing a brown leather jacket, jeans, and a sweater. She carried Alex, who was dressed in a blue winter jumper, in a baby carrier. Joe was in a good mood and looked great. She told the group that she had lost 15 pounds of the baby weight she had gained during her pregnancy and shared a picture of the small wedding ceremony she and Andy had held. They still had plans to move to Colorado, she said, but maybe in late 1995, when Alex was a little bigger. Life was good, it seemed, but she was glad to get out and see others since most of her days were spent at home with the baby. After lunch, their former Six Flags colleagues returned to work, and Joe and Hale stayed at the restaurant another 20 minutes or so that Joe could give the baby a bottle of formula. Hale then walked Joe to her car, a tan Toyota Corolla, and watched as she inserted the baby carrier back into its base in the front passenger seat. Both Hale and Joe then went to Six Flags themselves, in their separate cars, to drop in and visit some other old colleagues. They stayed there for about 45 minutes, catching up with different people, and Joe showing off the baby, and they both finally said their goodbyes and departed around 3:45 p.m. It wasn't until 4 days later, on Saturday, December 17th, that he learned that Joe was missing. Andy Katranek had left a message on his answering machine, something to the effect of, "Tim, this is Andy, Joanne's husband. I don't know if you know what's going on. Joanne and Alex were kidnapped on Thursday. I'm trying to find a private investigator. I know you're a cop now, so I thought maybe you would know someone I could hire." Hale then heard a second message on his machine from Joe's sister, Peggy. They had met once when Joe and he worked together. She told him, "Joe's missing. The Catasauqua police are involved," and that she had also called the FBI. After getting off the phone with Peggy, he called Andy. Andy told Hale that Joe and Alex were taken from the house, and he knew that because the car was still there. The police, said Andy, weren't doing enough.
Although the police had definitely been neglectful in those first 48 hours after Joe disappeared, by December 17th, they had begun an active investigation. Records show that in the following days, they interviewed dozens and dozens of locals, family members, and others who knew the Katranaks. As they canvassed the neighborhood, one thing became very clear. The area was extremely busy during the workday. The blocks around the Katranak home were filled with industrial-type businesses, building and landscape companies, as well as busy bars and restaurants that local workers popped in and out of all day. Deliveries happened around the clock, deliveries to businesses, deliveries from the businesses. Report after report of people who were right there, working on the very block where Joe and Andy lived. People coming in and out of cars, workers who were part of the first or second or third wave of lunch patrons at McCarty's bar right next to the house, all said the same thing. No one saw anything. Not a thing. All day on December 15th. No one saw a woman and her baby being kidnapped. No one saw Joe's car being parked at McCarty's parking lot. No one saw a fight or commotion or anything suspicious at all. This is not hyperbole. Luke Fritzinger, a postal worker, saw nothing. Sandra Flores, a neighbor who left her house around 1 p.m. to go shopping, saw nothing. Edward Nant, a local worker who got off around 2:30 p.m., saw nothing. Richard Bird, a McCarty's employee, saw nothing. Jamie Smith, a neighbor who was out walking between 1:30 and 2 p.m., saw nothing. David Shook, who worked across the street from the Katranaks until 2:30 p.m. daily, saw nothing. Rochelle Santiago, who worked until noon in the same block as the Katranak residents, saw nothing. Myrtle Silfels, a neighbor who could see the Katranak home from her place, was home all day on December 15th, saw and heard nothing. Betty Ricci, an employee at Doormaster, could see the Katranaks home from work, saw nothing. Her multiple coworkers, who would come and go all day installing garage doors at customer homes, saw and heard nothing. Dina Reed, a neighbor who got her son from the bus stop every day at 12:30, saw nothing. Daryl Paul, a local worker who ate at McCarty's on December 15th from noon to 1:30 p.m., walking to and from work down the street, saw nothing. Dozens of other patrons who ate at McCarty's every day for lunch saw nothing. Michael Check, a local worker who was at his place of employment next door from the Katronachs from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and specifically was outside around 1:30 p.m. working with heavy equipment, saw nothing. According to him, traffic was always heavy on Front Street because it served as an alternate commuter route to the highway. It's so busy that street parking is nearly always full, and yet no one saw anything. There are many more police statements, more witnesses interviewed, who were in the immediate vicinity of the Katronach home on December 15, 1994, and saw and heard nothing. Given the constant activity that's documented in these police reports, it's fair to say there was likely not a chunk of time that afternoon that the street was completely empty. Remember that the phone call that afternoon between Jo and her mother-in-law is an important part of the timeline here. It would be allegedly the last time that anyone spoke to Jo before she disappeared. According to Veronica, Andy's mother, that call took place around 1:15 p.m., and she said that Jo was just getting her shoes on and heading right out with a baby. That would have been right in the middle of the lunch rush next door at McCarty's. If Jo had left home to go pick up her mother-in-law to go shopping that afternoon and had been kidnapped outside her home, which was Andy's theory, it seems nearly impossible that no one would have seen or heard anything at all.
Having said that, could someone have broken into the basement, cut the phone wire, waited for Jo to come out of the house, and then grabbed her and forced the baby into a vehicle right behind the house without anyone seeing? Sure, anything is possible, I guess, however unlikely. Here's the problem with that scenario, though. That would mean the perp returned to the scene just to back Jo's car in at McCarty's parking lot, which makes no sense whatsoever. A lot of things about the car make no sense, actually. If Jo and Alex were indeed kidnapped, there are only a few possibilities about how it went down. One possibility is that the perp parked their car in the area, took off with Jo and the baby in her car, then came back with her car and parked it before taking off in their own car. The other possibility is what was mentioned before, that Jo and Alex were abducted in someone else's car before she even made it to her car. In that case, either she was forced to back her car into McCarty's lot before leaving the scene, or the perp came back to park her car there. Another possibility is that Jo actually got in her car with the baby and drove off to pick up her mother-in-law, was intercepted somewhere along the way and abducted, but for some reason, the perp brought her car back to the Katronach neighborhood, meaning the perp knew that that's where she lived, and then they left the car there. Now, all these scenarios would be highly risky and deeply stupid for a perp to attempt. They would also be completely nonsensical. In other words, there's no logic to Jo's car being moved just around the way and left in a neighboring parking lot unless, well, there is exactly one scenario in which the crime scene makes sense. And that would be this, that Jo let the perp into her car by force or voluntarily, they drove to another location, and then the perp returned without Jo and the baby and parked the car at McCarty's because it was the most convenient thing to do. Why would it be convenient? Because McCarty's was close enough to where the perp lived that they could just walk home, and because the perp wanted to make sure the car was safe and secure, which it was, because it was left locked with the keys inside under the driver's side seat. Just stop for a second. Stop this podcast right now if you need to and ask why a perp who had no connection to the car, no stake in its security, would take the trouble to lock the door and leave the keys inside. Well, if you're picking up what I'm putting down, so did the police, naturally focusing on Andy as their prime suspect in the initial stages of the investigation.
Andy's story changed slightly every time he told it. And then, of course, there was the fact that the scene at the house was just odd. The alleged break-in didn't really seem like a break-in, and, like the car, didn't really have any rationale. if someone broke into the house to abduct Joe, what did they gain by cutting the mobile phone line, but not the other? Remember, the main phone, which is a wired line to a phone in the living room, was fully intact. If the perp was going to abduct Joe outside the house, why even break in to begin with and risk leaving evidence behind? Everything about the house and car looked staged, and yet the police couldn't quite pin Andy on anything because first, they didn't know if Joe had been abducted or left voluntarily. Second, Andy had an alibi all day. He'd been working 20 minutes away and had been seen at the job site by his father and Kathy and Tom Holschwander throughout the day. The case was definitely too complex for the Catasauqua police to handle. So early on, the Pennsylvania State Police took lead of the investigation and the FBI joined in shortly thereafter, given the possibility that Joe and Alex may have been taken across state lines forcibly. Of course, there was also the possibility that Joe had left voluntarily, and as rumor mills were wont to do, the rumor that Joe had taken off herself and was in Connecticut safe and sound was already being spread around the neighborhood. Investigators tracked it down to the purported source, and when questioned, the man who had begun it admitted making it up. Like that rumor, investigators had to further track down the many other leads coming their way. There was the U.S. Air employee at Lehigh Valley International Airport, who swore up and down he saw Joanne Katranak on December 15, 1994. According to him, an attractive woman with long dark hair had come in with an infant and bought a plane ticket. She wore a wedding ring, and there was a man with her, and they both appeared nervous. After looking at pictures of Joe, this airline employee was certain it was Joe. The police took the tip so seriously, they even hypnotized the witness to see what else he could remember. He again confirms the woman he saw matched the photo of Joe. He was wrong, though. After further digging, investigators were able to identify the woman and the man with her, who turned out to be her husband, and who was definitely not Joanne. They also determined the couple had traveled on December 16th and not the 15th. Joe is allegedly sighted at gas stations and convenience stores and Weight Watchers meetings, all to no avail, leads that went nowhere. Joe's exes were interviewed, her former co-workers interviewed, and again, no information that led to finding her.
Then there were the people who had visions and dreams of Joe, people who didn't even know the Katranaks, and thought their visions were important enough to report to the police. One friend of the family, actually a woman who used to date Andy, Teresa Benchini, took it a step further. She took a couple pieces of Joe's jewelry and a picture of the missing mother and child to a psychic herself. The psychic informed Teresa that Joe and the baby had been abducted by two men, both white males. One of the men, she said, was known to Joanne and her father and distrusted by the father. The other man had a dirty, unwashed appearance. The psychic could also see that Joe and Alex were initially abducted and taken to New Jersey, but then the kidnappers brought them back to Pennsylvania, apparently to avoid the seriousness of abducting someone over state lines. The psychic could see exactly where Joe and Alex were being held, on the second floor of a decrepit two-story home close to a courthouse in Easton, Pennsylvania. The kidnappers planned on keeping them hostage until Andy paid a ransom. Except there had been no ransom demand made by anybody. The police reports don't reflect that there was any hunt for this decrepit two-story home close to a courthouse in Easton, Pennsylvania, or whether any of the family undertook such a hunt. Regardless, this supernatural lead, along with another report from a different psychic who said that Joe and the baby were in Good Pines, Louisiana, went nowhere. There were also those who knew Joe and thought that she had left on her own. A number of her former colleagues described Joanne as someone who did not take direction from authority, wasn't easily intimidated, and got bored easily. Karen Devine, who knew Joe for 5 years since they worked together at United Jersey Bank, reported that Joe had gotten into a fight with a bank manager, yelling and cussing at them. She had a temper, according to Devine and according to Adrian Kalina, another co-worker at the bank. Kalina reported to the police that Joanne was defiant, to the point that she was about to get fired from the bank, so Kalina talked Joe into resigning instead. Karen Devine was certain that Joe could have easily upped and left Andy without a word and without looking back. Joe was selfish, said Devine, and looked out for herself before anyone else. Karen knew Andy from the beginning of the relationship. In fact, she had been with Joe the night that Joe and Andy first met, but she didn't like him very much. According to her police interview, Joe's family also didn't like Andy very much either, because it seemed he didn't want anything to do with them. Many years later, that same co-worker, Karen Devine, said in a television interview that Joe had told her that she was planning on leaving Andy after the holidays and was secretly saving money to do so. But you have to take that statement with a grain of salt, because she never reported it to the police when they were actively investigating. There is a chance that she did tell investigators back then and they left it out of the reports, but that seems highly unlikely. Remember, Andy was their prime suspect for quite a while, and information like this would have helped to make a case against him. So while what Karen Devine is saying is possible, some healthy skepticism doesn't hurt.
Skepticism is also required to consider what, at first glance, seems to be a very important sighting of Joe on December 15th by a neighbor. Stacy Fulper lived in a second-floor apartment in the house right next door to the Katronachs and had a direct view of Andy and Joe's backyard and gravel parking lot when she came in and out of her apartment using the stairs outside the home. Fulper was interviewed numerous times by both the Pennsylvania State Police as well as the FBI. In one such interview, she gave some startling information. Fulper said that on December 15th, she saw Joanne at approximately 12:30 p.m. According to Fulper, she had put down her own baby for a nap and then went outside and down the stairs to the laundry room. The laundry room gave her a clear view of the Katronach's backyard and laundry room. Fulper reported that she saw Joe outside in the lot doing something in her car. Both the front and rear passenger doors of Joe's car were open, and Fulper saw Joe was putting baby Alex in the car seat in the rear of the vehicle. Fulper recalled the time because as she was putting the baby down to sleep, she glanced at the clock. She specifically recalled that Joe was wearing a black jacket and blue jeans. When she went back out to put the laundry in the dryer around 1:15 p.m., the car was gone. Later that day, she went out again around 3 p.m. and again saw that Joe's car was gone. This is seemingly vital information in tracking Joe's last movements. After all, Stacy Fulper might have been the last person to see Joe before she disappeared. There are, however, a number of problems with this statement. The first problem being that Fulper never reported seeing Joe the first couple of times she was interviewed. It just so happened that the FBI interviewed another neighbor, Dina Reed, and Reed told the authorities that Fulper had told her about this sighting. When the FBI went back to Stacy Fulper and questioned her about whether she had said this to Dina Reed, Fulper suddenly changed her story and added the details about Joe. It doesn't necessarily mean that she made the whole thing up to impress her neighbor or insert herself into the story. It could be that she had seen Joe on a different day, and by the time of the later interview, had conflated the 2 days. Remember that Joe's mother-in-law, Veronica, said that she spoke to Joe around 1:15 p.m. When they spoke, Joe was getting ready to leave the house, and Veronica could hear the baby gurgling in the background. Veronica and Fulper's statements directly contradict each other based upon their timings. So one of them is wrong. It seems much more likely that Fulper's statement is the unreliable one. Fulper either created this story of seeing Joe on the day she disappeared as self-important gossip, or she was getting her days mixed up.
Few things are as important in a missing person's case than piecing together the timeline. In this case, the police had to take as gospel the word of the prime suspect, Andy, as to when Joanne and baby Alex were last seen, around 7 to 7:30 a.m. when he left for work that morning. Then the police have to take as gospel that Joe did in fact speak to her mother-in-law Veronica around 1:15 p.m., meaning that her disappearance took place after that time. Another couple of data points that are important to note in this timeline is that Veronica called her son's house to see what happened to Joe around 3 p.m. after she failed to pick her up. According to Veronica, the phone kept ringing, and the answering machine, which was connected to the mobile phone, didn't pick up. Earlier, when Veronica had spoken to Joe, she said Joe had been on that same mobile line because she was moving around the house, that same line that Andy found cut in the early morning hours of the next day. Likewise, Joe's friend and former co-worker, Adrian Kalina, called the Katranack home around 5:30 p.m. Again, the phone rang and rang without the answering machine picking it up. Both Veronica and Kalina said that this was highly unusual. In fact, it had never happened before. Joe always had the answering machine on. This means that the mobile line was working around 1:15 p.m. when Joe was speaking to Veronica. But by 3 p.m., when Veronica called back and it kept ringing and ringing, the line had been cut. Now, assuming Joe got off the phone with Veronica and then was abducted outside her home, forced to drive off in her car, then we have to figure out when the perp came back with the car. None of the McCarty's Bar patrons that visited the establishment during lunch waves reported seeing Joe's car there during the day, which makes sense if she was abducted at or after 1:30 p.m., driven off, and then the car was returned after the afternoon rush at the restaurant. But there was also a steady evening wave of patrons who hung out at McCarty's every night, including Jan Bogert and his girlfriend, Sandra Damian. Bogert and Damian lived right next door to the Katranacks, and every evening after work would walk from their home, passing Andy and Joe's house on the way to McCarty's Bar. According to Damian, there was a regular group of folks at McCarty's every evening from 5 to 7 p.m., including them. That night, on December 15th, as they walked to McCarty's, Jan Bowman glanced in the parking lot. A lone vehicle was parked in the first spot. And when he left, around 7 p.m., he again looked out into the lot and again saw only that single vehicle, which was not Joe's car.
As we noted before, Front Street was a busy street, both day and night. After work hours, the revelry went late into the night, thanks to both McCarty's and another bar, the Front Street Bar, which was the next block over. On the night of December 15th, Kevin Schuler and his wife Sandra headed over to the Front Street Bar around 11:30 p.m. Kevin parked his 1988 gray Astra van in the parking lot that was diagonal to the Front Street Bar, McCarty's parking lot. He parked in the third spot from the street, right next to a tan Toyota Corolla that was backed into the second spot, Joe's car. As the couple got out of their van, they walked past the Toyota on their way to the bar and noticed a baby car seat in the front passenger seat. The couple stayed at the bar until about 2:10 a.m., and when they returned to their car, they noticed two people standing in McCarty's lot, hovering by the tan Toyota. He later learned that the two people were the parents of Joe Katranack, and they also saw a man walking away from the lot toward the residence next door, which was Joe's husband, Andy Katranack. Schuler spoke to the parents and told them that he and his wife had seen the car when they arrived around 11:30 p.m., but also that they had seen the car earlier in the day, too, at around 12:30 p.m. in the afternoon. According to Schuler, he and his wife had visited the Front Street Bar earlier in the day to grab lunch. They parked in the street, though, and not in the McCarty's lot. Kevin Schuler said that he glanced over at McCarty's to see if there were any cars he recognized there, and he noticed the same tan Toyota Corolla in the lot, in exactly the same position. His wife Sandra confirmed the same, that when they had come for lunch, Joe's car was in the McCarty's parking lot. If what the Schuler said was accurate, well, it's pretty perplexing. Absolutely no one else, from patrons to employees at McCarty's, saw Joe's car in the lot that afternoon. In fact, another witness named Ralph Guth, who visited the Front Street Bar for lunch at nearly the same time as the Schulers and also parked in the street like them, confirmed that McCarty's lot was completely empty when he arrived around 1 p.m. Is there a slim possibility that Joe's car was in the McCarty's lot for a brief period in the afternoon, at a time before Joe even spoke to her mother-in-law and left to go shopping? Then it was moved from the lot so that no one else saw it all day, and then it was returned again that evening. Anything is possible, but this seems highly unlikely. What seems fairly certain, however, is that Joe's car was not there around 7 p.m. when Jan Bogert and his girlfriend, Sandra Damian, left McCarty's, but it was there by 11:20 p.m. when the Schulers arrived for their late-night visit.
If nothing about the timeline makes sense, or how Joe and Alex were abducted makes sense, or why her car was brought back to the neighborhood by the perp, if it ever left at all, makes sense, well, hold on to your seats. Because while the police were suspecting Andy, the person he was suspecting makes even less sense than anything we've gone over so far. According to Andy, just a few days before his wife disappeared, they received a phone call at their home around 9 o'clock at night. His wife, Joe, picked up the phone, said a few choice words, told the caller not to call again, and hung up. The call was from Patricia Rohrer, an ex-girlfriend of Andy's. Andy and Patty, as her friends called her, had dated on and off for years, broken up long ago, and had eventually fallen into a casual friendship, checking in with each other once or twice a year. The night of Joe's disappearance, after her car was found in McCarty's parking lot, Andy remembered that phone call. He remembered how rude Joanne was to Patty, and he remembered that Patty could be crazy. What if Patty had something to do with Joe and Alex's disappearance? He needed to find out where Patty Rohrer was that night, but he didn't have her number. He was able to get her mother's number from his father. Patty's mother was also named Patricia Chambers. At 3:14 a.m., Andy made the first of three calls to Mrs. Chambers. When she picked up, Andy asked for Patty's number and told her that his wife and son had been kidnapped. He also told her that he was worried that someone may have been stalking Joe when she went for her walks with the baby, that Joe's car had been found abandoned nearby, and that the phone line in his home had been cut. According to Andy, Mrs. Chambers told him she would call Patty and get right back to him. When she called back minutes later, she told him that Patty was fast asleep in her home and had been awakened by her phone call. Patty didn't know anything, and she hadn't left town at all in the past 10 days. The town that Patty was in for the past 10 days, the town that she lived in, was Linwood, North Carolina. It was approximately 530 miles from the Katranack residence, a nine-hour drive away. Andy hung up the phone, seemingly satisfied by Mrs. Chambers, although he didn't get Patty's number himself to call her. And Patty made the fatal mistake not to call him that night either. Fatal, because if she had called him, it would have been incontrovertible proof that she was in North Carolina on the night that Joanne and baby Alex disappeared. But because she didn't make that call, where Patty was on December 15th became the central question when, months later, the bodies of Joanne and Alex Katranack were found. Next time on Undisclosed. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more Undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer three quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2 with the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.